Our next presenter is Dr. Jeff Yu. Dr. Yu is an assistant professor of dermatology at Harvard Medical School and a dual board certified adult and pediatric dermatologist practicing at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much, and thank you to the organizers for having me here to talk to you guys about this topic that I'm not sure how many of you guys are familiar with or how many of you guys really do in clinic, but something that is near and dear to my heart and I've been working on for about the last 6 years or so. Like the introduction said, my name is Dr. Yu, and I am a contact dermatologist specialist at Mass General Hospital in Boston. What I spend most of my week doing is actually patch testing patients. So during this talk, we're going to talk about patch testing, we're going to talk about interesting cases in contact dermatitis, and we're going to talk about different types of regional dermatoses and mimickers that can look like contact dermatitis that can oftentimes confuse us a little bit when we're just seeing them in the clinic. I do have a few disclosures here. I do some clinical trials, but none of this is relevant to our talk today. And some of the learning objectives here is, number one, what is contact dermatitis? Many of my patients, many of my colleagues, many dermatologists do not know what contact dermatitis is, so we're going to kind of walk through that a little bit so we know what's contact dermatitis and maybe what's a food allergy, which are two very different things. But patients often come in and ask, is this something I am eating? We're going to describe how patch testing works so you can kind of see what the flow is and whether or not it's something you want to implement in your practice. We're going to talk about the most common patterns of contact dermatitis. So when it involves the eyelid, what could it possibly be? When it involves the hands or the feet, what could it possibly be? And then finally, the mimickers, because I've been fooled and you will be fooled. It sees us a lot more often than we see it. So those are some of the things that I want to make sure that we bring up a little bit in this talk here. So just a quick show of hands, how many people here do patch testing? Wow, that's a lot. So good for you guys. How many of you guys work in clinics that do patch testing? My guess is probably even more. That's fantastic. So we're going to talk a little bit about what is allergic contact dermatitis first, so we kind of set the record straight a little bit here. So my favorite example of allergic contact dermatitis is, especially on a beautiful fall day like today, you go out for a walk, and what do you see on the side of the road but these beautiful little leaves that you really just want to bend over and touch them, right? Like, I want to touch that. But what happens after you touch those leaves? Well, you're going to end up with a rash that looks like this. After usually not 30 minutes, not an hour, probably not even that same day when you went on that fateful hike, it's probably about 24, 72, 96 hours later, are you going to develop this very streaky, very itchy vesicular rash? And we probably see all of this come into our clinic, especially in the spring, in the summer, in the fall months, right? People come in with a really itchy rash. Where did you go? I went hiking last weekend. My dog went hiking last weekend. Somebody went hiking last weekend, and you came in contact with poison and ivy. So it's an itchy rash that due to something that you come in contact with. What that means is that the mold in the corner of your ceiling is not what's causing your contact dermatitis. The food that you ate at dinner last night is not what's causing your contact dermatitis. And an allergic contact dermatitis also requires prior sensitization. The best evidence for this is that in the United States, where we have so much poison ivy, poison sumac, or poison oak, about 80 to 90% of everybody sitting in this room is allergic to one of those plants, if not all three of them. You go to a different country that doesn't have poison ivy, poison oak, or poison sumac, nobody is allergic to those plants because they've never come in contact with it. So we're not born with contact dermatitis, but we develop it throughout life. So how many of your patients come in and say, I've been using, you know, Nivea cream on my skin for the last 50 years and I've never had a problem, how could it possibly be the problem now? This is exactly why, because at some point on our body, we flipped a switch and we said, I'm going to become allergic to whatever this is that's in that Nivea cream, and then we're going to develop a dermatitis to it from that day on. Maybe not the 50 years ago, but maybe just today. So something that can certainly happen. So we know that contact dermatitis is a type 4 delayed type hypersensitivity reaction. It is not a type 1, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. This is highly dependent on these T cells that are just freely swimming around in our bodies, sometimes sitting around in lymph nodes, just waiting for that contact allergen to appear. When the contact allergen appears on the skin, it gets brought in by these cells called Langerhans cells. It migrates over into a lymph node, teaches all these T cells just sitting around waiting to be primed what this allergen is. Nobody knows why that happens or why it happens when it does, but all we know is that this process happens before the sensitization occurs, and then those T cells are now ready, so the next time you come in contact with poison ivy, those T cells come out of marching out of those lymph nodes, going into your skin and causing an itchy rash that appears. But this is why it takes so long, because these are not due to mast cells that are just free floating in your skin, waiting to see that food allergen or waiting to see that dust mite. It has to come out from the lymph nodes, so it takes 24, 48, 72 hours usually before the rash occurs. How do we treat this? We treat it with topical steroids, right? This is not something that antihistamines are necessarily going to treat because this is not due to a histamine process. This is due to a T-cell process very similar to atopic dermatitis, for example. So contact dermatitis is not usually a food allergy because unlike a food allergy, when you eat something you're allergic to, like peanuts, if you're eating peanut butter, 15 to 30 minutes later, what's gonna happen? You're gonna get swelling on your face, your eyes are gonna swell, your lips are gonna swell, you're gonna end up with what looks like urticaria or hives all over your body, right? God forbid, sometimes you might have difficulty breathing, difficulty with chest pains and stomach aches and things like that. And all that is due to this tiny little cell there that's present in all of our bodies called mast cells. These mast cells are just floating around waiting for something to trigger it so it can release its boatload of histamines into your skin, causing all of these reactions. So then the treatment here are going to be your antihistamines. But so when a patient comes into clinic, I will ask them two questions to know whether or not they really need to be there. Number one, how long does your rash stay around for? Because we know that urticaria, for example, sticks around for less than 24 hours, right? Like, that's kind of the parting line there. If you have eczema, your rash sticks around for much longer than just 24 hours. If you have a rash that comes and goes within 24 hours, it's probably urticaria. Number two, what do antihistamines do for you? If they're like, man, I pop a Zyrtec and my skin is much better and I feel great, that's probably not contact dermatitis, because we know that type 4 hypersensitivity is not really treated by antihistamines. Perhaps they're using topical steroids and then taking oral antihistamines and they feel better, that's okay. But if just an antihistamine alone takes care of it, it's probably not contact dermatitis, and therefore patch testing is not going to help you very much. So how prevalent is contact dermatitis and why should we really care? Well, the American Academy of Dermatology did a study looking at the prevalence of contact dermatitis through the different age groups. And we know that starting in kids, about 33% of children have contact dermatitis of some sort, at least reported. And then in adults, we see about 1 in 5 adults having some sort of contact dermatitis. So this problem probably sees you a lot more often than you see it, because sometimes they come in with rashes and we're like, ah, put some triamcinolone on there, it'll probably get better. But at the end of the day, that may be a contact dermatitis that could occur again and again and again until we do some sort of patch testing to avoid it. So we do have some data on contact dermatitis. It's not just poison ivy. There are a lot of other contact allergens that we all come in contact with that we should be aware of. There is a group of dermatologists in both in both the United States as well as Canada that kind of pool all of our data together, and we're called the North American Contact Dermatitis Group. We probably patch test several thousand patients per year, and we pool our data together and we publish this every year or two, looking at the different prevalent contact allergens here. Now, I'm not gonna go through and talk about all of these different contact allergens, but you can see on this list that nickel is the number one contact allergen, and it has been so for about the last 20 years, or the last several decades or so. It shouldn't really be surprising, because the most common place we come in contact with nickel is, well, everywhere, right? Anytime you get a piercing, anytime you get cheap jewelry, anytime you wear costume jewelry, your belt buckle, your ID badge, anything that's silvery and cheap probably contains nickel in it. So again, we're always exposed to nickel, therefore our bodies really have this great opportunity of generating a contact dermatitis to that. Some of these other allergens on this list, like MI, which stands for methyl isothiazolinone, fragrance mix, hydroperoxides of linalool, these are all different types of allergens, including preservatives as well as fragrances, that are really common for people to react to. Where can you find these things? We're thinking shampoos, we're thinking detergents, we're thinking face creams, sunscreens, things like that, that can often contain these allergens. Now, there's no way you're gonna be able to look at this person and say, oh, I think you are allergic to balsam of Peru. You probably can't really do that unless you're really, really, really good, but usually requires some sort of patch testing to be able to figure out that type of allergen. So in this study, at least, that was published in about 2019, looking at the cycle data between 2017 and 2018, about 50% of the patients who were patch tested had a final diagnosis of allergic contact dermatitis, and then 11% of them had some sort of occupational exposure, which is also extremely important, especially in adults. Now, some of you out there in the audience who do patch testing might be using the True Test, which is a great test, right? It's a test that comes prepackaged. You put it in the fridge, patient comes in, needs patch testing, you pop it out of the fridge, open the foil, stick it on their back, and you kind of go from there. The only problem with the True Test is that it's a relatively limited way of patch testing. You're only looking at about 35 different allergens and one negative control, so you're putting 36 different things on their back. You're gonna miss about 30 to 40% of all relevant allergens. So what that means is that if the patient is negative on True Test, I'm not really confident enough to say you don't have allergic contact dermatitis. All I can really say is that we didn't find a contact allergen, but I don't really know if you are allergic to it or not. So I'm gonna go through some better ways of patch testing to be a little bit more comprehensive. So how do we patch test here? One person once said greatest failure in patch testing is not patching at all. It's probably not Confucius. I just couldn't remember who said it, so I'm just going to throw that on there anyway. So there are different levels of patch testing, or the way that we kind of think about it. There's that basic level of patch testing that a lot of us can provide in the clinic, and that's the true test. But like I said before, it misses about 40% of relevant positive reactions. There's the intermediate way, so kind of one step above that. If you want to be a little bit more comprehensive, you can use one of these pre-made core series that are out there. What the core series entails are just all the allergens that we think patients are most likely to react to. Usually these core series contain somewhere between 50, 65, 70, or 80, or 90 different allergens, depending on which one you buy. But the problem with this one is that you're still going to miss about 10% of the positive reactions. Now, that's a whole lot better than missing 30 to 40%, because if they're negative on the core, you can say, well, I'm 90% sure you don't have a contact dermatitis. Now, the patch testing that we do at our center is called the advanced patch testing, where not only are we putting on core allergens, I'm also tailoring the allergen to your exposure. So for example, if you were a 25-year-old woman coming into my clinic with eyelid dermatitis, I'm going to put the core patch series on you, but I'm also going to test you to the cosmetic series, which is going to be 35 additional allergens that's going to look more specifically at the things that are in your cosmetic products. If you're someone that comes in and says my scalp itches all the time every time I get a hair dye, I have a specific hair tray that looks at not just paraphenylene diamine that many of you might recognize as the most common hair-related allergen, but some of the other allergens that are out there as well, including things like toluene 2,5-diamine, M-aminophenol. These are other types of dye chemicals that patients can also be allergic to. If you're someone that comes in having had dental work done and you come in with my lips are chapped all the time, I have colitis of some sort, I have a specific dental tray I can use on you. So these are different types of extended series that we can use in addition to the core series to really increase our yield of detection for contact dermatitis. By doing this, I can say more confidently that your rash is probably not due to a contact dermatitis if I don't find anything relevant on patch testing. This is what the true test looks like. You guys may be familiar with that. This is what the core series looks like when you buy it. So when you buy it, it doesn't come nicely prepackaged. It comes in these syringes that a nurse usually has to dispense into the individual chambers. When we are looking at patch test reactions, there are different ways that we grade them. There's the super positive, the extreme positive on the upper left-hand corner, which looks like a blister. There's the strong positive, the weak positive, and some of the more doubtful-like reactions. Patients will always want to know, what is my strongest reaction? Because he or she thinks that that is what is linked to the most likely allergen. That is absolutely false. It doesn't really matter how strong a reaction is. A positive reaction is a positive reaction, and we don't really know what is causing your dermatitis until we explore it a little bit further. So for example, someone comes in with a face rash. They are strongly positive to nickel. Now, unless you're rubbing some metallic thing all over your face, chances are that's not what's causing your face rash. But if you had a weak positive reaction to a chemical called lanolin, and lanolin that a lot of us might recognize is a sheep oil that's commonly found in some moisturizers like Eucerin, Aquaphor, things like that, and they're using that on their face, chances are that weak reaction to lanolin is much more relevant than the strong reaction to nickel. So this is where that history is really important. You get the reactions and you get the positive test result, but it's not helpful to you unless you know where it is and why it's causing the patient's rash. So how does patch testing work? Well, on Monday, my patients come in and I ask them a bunch of really annoying questions, right? I ask them, what do you use on your hair? What do you use on your face? What do you use on your hands? Do you get manicures done? And trust me, over the last few years, I've learned a lot about how people get their nails done in a lot of different terms that I never thought I had to learn. And recently, we just had someone that was allergic to the waxing that they do on their face. So I'm actually having my med students go out to different waxing salons and try to figure out what it is that they do there and what they use there, because I personally have never been to one. And I figured if I went to a waxing salon asking that question, they're going to think I'm creepy. So on Monday, we come in, we ask them questions, and then my nurse makes up those patch test panels, and she puts them on the patient's back. And then what happens is we tape over it. So you can see here on the left-hand side, and I do patch test a lot of kids. On the left-hand side, we put the patches on, and then they cover it with this type of tape so the patches do not get dislodged. And these photos are published in a JADCME article that I wrote with some students on pediatric patch testing. On Wednesday, when they come back, we take all the patches off and we kind of do a preliminary read and we see if there are reactions that are starting to form. Patients often want to know, are there positive reactions at this point? There could be, but we don't really know yet because sometimes positive reactions are still developing because this is only 48 hours after our initial patch test application. Then they come back on Friday for the final read, so yes, this does take a week to do. And on Friday is when we usually will say, these are the positive reactions that we see. What are we looking for here? You see those kind of red squares that you see on the photo, at least four from where I'm standing. Those are positive reactions. We know what's an allergen well, number one, number 12, for example, number eight, things like that. I can usually tell patients what your positive reactions are. That's why marking them is so important. Now, patch testing is not the same as prick testing, so not all allergy tests are made the same. Patch testing looks for allergic contact dermatitis. It takes a week to do. Prick testing looks for immediate type hypersensitivity and immediate type reactions, food, mold, pollen, cats, dogs, things like that, right? And that takes about 30 minutes in the clinic. Two very different tests looking for two very different diagnoses with two very different timelines. Usually, the dermatologist will do the patch testing. Usually, the allergist will do the prick testing. So, if you guys are looking for someone to do more comprehensive patch testing because you're either unable to offer it in the clinic or you guys are not currently doing it, the American Contact Dermatitis Society has a really helpful find a provider page. You can type in the zip code, you can see who is doing comprehensive patch testing in the area around you, and sometimes by doing that preliminary patch testing in your clinic, and if you don't find anything, perhaps referring them to somebody that is doing more comprehensive patch testing could be helpful. So that's kind of my spiel on patch testing in general. Now we're going to get to kind of the meat of this talk, which is recognizing different types of contact dermatitis presentations as well as some mimickers. Now, I really like to think about contact dermatitis regionally because rarely do I have someone come in with a full body rash that I'm like, oh yeah, that's contact dermatitis. That's a little bit more less likely. Usually when people come in, they have eyelid dermatitis, they have hand dermatitis, they have feet dermatitis, they have dermatitis just involving the axilla, for example. Patterns like that can sometimes help you figure out, is this allergic contact dermatitis? Are they worth patch testing? And what could some of the potential suspected allergens be? All right, so starting from the scalp area here, so patterns of ACD on the scalp. Now you can see there are certain patterns of allergic contact dermatitis that can sometimes appear. What you notice is that the scalp is not colored in, right? Like why is the head not completely red when we're talking about allergic contact dermatitis to the scalp? Most of the time, and most of you have hair, congratulations, we have hair and that prevents a lot of the allergens from coming in direct contact with our scalp. So even when we're washing our hair and shampooing, the shampoo is probably on there for 1, maybe 2 minutes before it really gets rinsed off. So what we really see is more of a rash adjacent to the scalp because that is the pattern of where the shampoo comes in direct contact with the skin and where it kind of gets rinsed off. Another reason why the scalp is not a great area to develop contact dermatitis is because of the amount of oil glands we have up there. Oftentimes that kind of rinses off a lot of the contact allergens before they have a chance to stimulate our immune system. The most common cause of scalp or scalp adjacent related dermatitis are different types of hair dyes, perming solutions, which we're doing a little bit less nowadays compared to 20, 30 years ago, shampoos, hair growth solutions like topical minoxidil. Now, these are things that we're using a lot in our hair loss patients, right? Paraphenylenediamine is by far the most common hair dye chemical that is related to scalp dermatitis. A lot of dyes now won't use PPD anymore, but they will use chemicals that are similar to PPD that people can certainly still develop a reaction for. Now, here are some pictures of just scalp dermatitis, for example. You can see most of the redness in the rash is kind of right behind the ears, on the back of the neck. The scalp is oftentimes pretty clear, if not completely clear. And then the forehead area is another good place to develop dermatitis. A lot of these patients, I wonder about their shampoo, their conditioner, their hairspray, their hair mousse, their dry shampoo, whatever else it may be that they use on their scalp that could be causing this dermatitis. Common mimickers here that you guys probably see in clinic as well. Scalp psoriasis, right? The picture on the left-hand side, these well-demarcated silvery pink plaques with kind of that micaceous scale appearing that you can put your finger around or take a pen and draw around it. That's scalp psoriasis. Those patients are not great candidates for patch testing. They're better candidates for intralesional Kenalog. The picture on the right-hand side, for example, that's seborrheic dermatitis that we all see as well. Again, kind of the lack of a dermatitis really around the scalp adjacent areas, much more of this diffuse, greasy flaking that you see on the scalp. That's more seborrheic dermatitis, less likely contact dermatitis of some sort. Now, kind of moving on to the face here, there are various presentations of what contact dermatitis could look like on the face. You can kind of get this more scattered pattern, especially. Women tend to get a lot more facial dermatitis than men, purely because women tend to be more exposed to different types of allergens than men are. Now, certainly that is not the case across the board, but usually when patients come in with, say, isolated eyelid dermatitis, facial rash, or whatnot, typically they tend to be female rather than male. Face rash can also develop not just because of the products that we're using directly on our skin, but say if you have an essential oil diffuser in the room, say if you have Glade plugins, if you're using scented candles, any sort of aerosolized fragrances can kind of land on our exposed body surface areas. So our face, for example, our necks, our hands, those are common places for this airborne pattern of contact dermatitis, and I will always ask about those. I kind of briefly mentioned picture A there a little bit. That's the rinse-off pattern that we often see with scalp products, but they can sometimes show up as facial dermatitis as well. When we kind of wash our hair, the shampoo rinses off the side of our face coming down the side of our neck. That is very commonly a shampoo allergy, not something that they are using. Versus the photos on the bottom there, that kind of patchy picture, it's more likely to be something they're using all over their face, whether it's your daily moisturizer, whether it's your sunscreen, whether it's your foundation, things like that can all cause that kind of patchy picture, and I will certainly get a very detailed inventory of what it is that you are using. Now, this is a little bit of a double-edged sword because I often tell patients to bring everything in. The guys will bring in one 7-in-1 product and be like, this is all I use. The women will bring in a trunk full of, you know, 10 different types of cosmetic products from 5 different retailers, so it makes it a little bit more difficult, but it's really important to kind of take note of what it is that they are using, and sometimes I will patch test them directly to their own products as well, because that could be really helpful to say it's this one product that is causing your rash, or is this one face wash, for example. This is a case of someone who had this kind of scalp-adjacent dermatitis induced by zinc pyrithione. This is an anti-seborrheic dermatitis compound that's used in things like Head and Shoulder and various other types of dandruff shampoos as well. But you can see it's really not the scalp that's involved. It's really kind of the forehead, back of the ears, neck, and sometimes even the back of the hands, because you're kind of using that to rinse it into your scalp, for example. So this is a patient that I saw in my clinic that came in with a 60-year-old, she was a 60-year-old female with new onset facial rash that occurred about 3 months ago. She's been given multiple prednisone tapers that were helpful, but of course, as you know, once you come off of prednisone, you get a rebound, and then we want to go back on prednisone again because it's such an amazing medication and for the time being. She was painting a condo starting in about October, and they finished in November, and she's been living in that unit when she kind of developed this rash, and that's what she looked like. So this kind of very impressive erythematous, you know, well-demarcated pink patches that kind of show up on her face, malar cheeks, nose, kind of that the melolabial folds, places like that around the mouth. So pretty diffuse clinical picture here of just this really flaming bad face rash. What do? Of course, we patch test her, otherwise I wouldn't be talking about her. And she had a positive reaction to a chemical called methylisothiazolinone. If you think back to that original table that I showed you, methylisothiazolinone is the number 2 most common allergen out there. Now, it's not helpful to say, oh, you're allergic to methylisothiazolinone, see you later, good luck, right? You kind of have to tie it back and see, why does this make sense? Why is it relevant to why she has that rash? So we know that she was painting her house, and we know that paint contains methylisothiazolinone and the other types of isothiazolinones. About 90-some percent of all household paints not declared on the SDS sheets will contain some sort of isothiazolinone. When we told her that it's likely related to your house paint, and that is why you're developing a face rash, she moved in with a friend for about a month or two, let her place kind of air out a little bit. Her friend got tired of her. She tried to go back to her apartment. She actually broke out in the rash again, and she moved out into a tent in her backyard because she really didn't have another place to go. And then she moved back into her apartment a few weeks later, and then things were okay. It could take several weeks for the paint to really air out and the allergen concentration to decrease enough. But it's helpful to tell them what it is that they're allergic to and why. This is a really great paper that I oftentimes reference when I'm thinking about different types of rashes on the face, because certainly it's more than just allergic contact dermatitis. You can have rosacea, you can have periorificial dermatitis, you can have Demodex, you can have topical steroid withdrawal, malassezia, all these other things can potentially cause hand dermatitis, but this is a really great picture in terms of kind of just painting that through for us here. Other pictures that we should kind of be cognizant about, the one on the left, of course, the form of rosacea, the erythrotelangiectatic form of rosacea, and then on the right-hand side, in darker skin especially, when we're dealing with seborrheic dermatitis, it can look a little bit hypopigmented, and we should not miss that. Certainly lupus is something we often think about. I have been fooled by lupus before. There was someone that came to the clinic with kind of a rash on their face. People thought it was due to glasses frames. We patch tested them. They didn't get much better. We tried treating it with topical medications, didn't get much better. And then one day when I saw her, I'm like, you know, it looks a little bit atrophic-y to me. So we should biopsy it. And then it came back as lupus. So certainly a lot of these patients can present initially looking like they have some sort of dermatitis, but close follow-up with them afterwards, they're really not responding to allergen avoidance like they should be or topical treatments. On the right-hand side there is a boy that has tinea facie on their face. Certainly that can fool us as well. I have been fooled by someone with hand dermatitis that came in. She was a vet. She's been treated with topical steroids for months before coming in to see me, patch tested her to all the gloves, all those things that she potentially uses. One day she wasn't responding. I was like, you know, just for the hell of it, let's scrape it, full of tinea. So all of it was tinea due to her contacts with various animals in her vet practice, and then she was flaring because we've been putting topical steroids on there. So always things to kind of just think about as mimickers for contact dermatitis. A lot of us are probably using dupilumab in our practice now for atopic dermatitis. You have probably seen head and neck dermatitis due to dupilumab or head and neck flaring. There are three different causes for it. Number one, malassezia. So a lot of times for these patients, I will treat them with oral antifungals like itraconazole. Number two, contact dermatitis. They all come to me because I do patch test them. And one recent study found that about 50 to 60% of them improved after patch testing. Number three, due to dupilumab. If that's really the case, stopping dupilumab usually will lead to resolution of their head and neck dermatitis. No one really knows why yet. Periorbital dermatitis is something that I see a lot. A lot of times, if you're looking at the eyelid rash, you want to see something called the four eyelid sign. If they just have the left upper eyelid involvement, it's probably not contact dermatitis, right? Like, what touches just one eyelid unless they wore like an eye patch? But usually you're gonna be thinking about bilateral eyelid involvement, upper as well as lower. Causes of that include things such as makeup products, of course, face creams, shampoos, conditioners. Some people might ask, well, why is it just my eyelids, not the rest of my face? Because your eyelids are thinner, they're a little bit more sensitive, they're a little bit more prone to irritation, therefore they are more likely to develop allergic contact dermatitis. So people with eyelid dermatitis, I think about everything they use from the neck up, sunscreen, perfume, aerosolized fragrances, shampoo, conditioner, hair dye, nails, because we touch our face a million times a day, right? If you have manicured nails, sometimes that can be the reason why you have an eyelid dermatitis as well. This is case number two of an eyelid dermatitis. It's a 78-year-old lady that comes in after her glaucoma surgery, developed this rash around her eyes. She's got a history of uveitis as well as glaucoma, and she's using eye drops. But she kind of stopped both of them without it really helping with her rash. She was previously treated for blepharitis, tried warm compresses, baby shampoos, cleansers. None of it really did very much for her. She tried some Systane, also didn't do much for her. You can see her eyelids here, this four eyelid sign, right? You can see the upper eyelid involvement, the lower eyelid involvement with some of that edema around there. We patch tested her. She was treated with topical hydrocortisone. She also applies Aquaphor. You might just look at this case and be like, it's the Aquaphor, I know. When you know it's something, it's never that thing, all right? And that's what I've learned from clinical practice. You put all these patches on her and you see that number one there has a positive reaction. What is number one? It's an allergen called benzocaine. Benzocaine is an ester anesthetic, sometimes injected, sometimes used topically. But she says, I've never put topical anesthetics on my skin. She's never had an issue with dental or dermatologic procedures in the past, never had an issue. But remember, she has an eye history, so she goes to her eye doctor about twice a month, two different ophthalmologists. Each time they use this chemical called Altaflor, and that's fluorescein that looks for corneal abrasions and stuff like that. It's that yellow gunk that they put in your eyes. Plus it has binoxynate, which is oxybupricane, which is an ester anesthetic. We never would have figured that out until we did the patch testing. We found that she had a positive reaction to benzocaine. We referred her back to our, you know, ophthalmologist, and we asked, like, you know, where are you using some sort of anesthetic in her eye? Less than a month later, her eyes were completely clear once they switched it over to something different. So again, history itself doesn't really help you because patients might not know what it is that they're exposed to. Patch testing them and then going back from there can be by far the most helpful. Things to not forget that you can also have other eye diseases, right? As a dermatologist, I don't think about the eyes very much. To me, eye has one organ and that's called the eyeball. I don't know anything else about the eyes. But you can also have blepharitis, so which is that picture on the left-hand side, that kind of upper lower lid swelling, a lot of that kind of, you know, crud that kind of shows up, that's the technical term, crud, that shows up right around the eyes in the morning, baby shampoo, warm compresses, things like that can oftentimes help. On the right-hand side, that's a photo of periorbital psoriasis, these very well-demarcated silvery plaques that shows up right around the eyes, can sometimes look like contact dermatitis, but that ends up being psoriasis there. So hands. We see hands a lot. Adults are oftentimes afflicted with hand dermatitis. By far the most common cause of hand dermatitis is irritant contact dermatitis, right? We washed our hands too much. We're using bad stuff on our hands. You work in healthcare, you wash your hands 1,000 times a day. Irritant contact dermatitis is by far the most common, followed by allergic contact dermatitis. About 10% of the general population is affected by hand dermatitis. Hands are frequently prone to immersion from wet environments, caustic chemical contact, and is the number one cause or one of the leading causes of occupational disability. So people are taking time off work because they just cannot work anymore because their hands hurt. It's hard to tell from irritant contact dermatitis. Biopsy is never gonna be helpful, right? When's the last time you biopsied a hand rash and you're like, oh yeah, I got the answer now? It's gonna come back as like psoriasiform dermatitis, spongiotic dermatitis with psoriasiform features. Like, it's never really helpful unless it's like tinea. So I never find biopsying hand rashes very helpful to in terms of differentiating between different types of rashes. So sometimes patch testing them is the only way you're really gonna be able to either rule in or rule out patch testing. So this is a 49-year-old scrub nurse that came in 2 months of hand dermatitis. That's worse when she's at work. She's been working as a scrub nurse for 20 years. Never had a problem until 2 months before she came into clinic. She knows that on the days when she has to scrub into surgery, her hands get much worse within a few hours of wearing sterile gloves. When she's off for a few days on the row, in a row, or when she's on vacation, her hands are completely fine. That is the perfect history for occupational dermatoses, right? If I'm wondering if someone's allergic to something they're using at work, I will always ask the question, what happens on the weekends? What happens when you take a few days off? What happens if you're off for a week or two? Does your rash clear? If the answer is no, or if the answer is it gets worse or stays the same, it's probably not something they only see at work. But for her, it was. So her hands, overall, very swollen, very red, very itchy, very painful, and she just says, it's so uncomfortable to be in that OR, I'm really unable to use my hands, really causing her to take months off work because she just can't get her hands any better, or she has to kind of switch her job. We patch tested her and we found that she was allergic to N,N-diphenylguanidine as well as 2-mercaptobenzothiazole. These are both rubber accelerators. We're so used to thinking about hand dermatitis and rubber allergy as latex, right? We don't really see that much latex allergy anymore because most places don't use latex gloves anymore because of the risk of type 1 hypersensitivity. Instead, we're using nitrile gloves. Don't be fooled, nitrile is still rubber. If they were to make a rubber glove, it still includes chemicals that makes that rubber glove what it is. These are called rubber accelerators. So it's the chemicals added to the process of taking that gum rubber from a tree into a usable human product and catalyzing that reaction. So these are just two of the various different rubber accelerators we do patch tests for. And that's what they were. They were in her nitrile gloves. We got rid of her nitrile gloves, and then she got better. There's a great paper out there that has gloves that do not contain rubber accelerators. They're still rubber gloves, they're neoprene gloves, and they're still sterile for surgical use as well as non-sterile for patient care purposes. So if you have someone in the clinic who might be allergic to the gloves that they're using, those are great options to start with, and not resorting to those vinyl kind of plasticky gloves that sometimes food service workers and people use because you really need that dexterity for patient care. So other things that you can see, well, when I see a really well-demarcated scaly rash on the palms, for example, my first thought is psoriasis, all right? So when I see that kind of, you can, again, draw a circle around it, very well-demarcated, just in the central palms, to me, that is psoriasis until proven otherwise. The picture on the right-hand side, that's more of a irritant contact dermatitis picture, sharp cutoff at the wrist, involves the interweb, so that's one of the areas that we often don't see in allergic contact dermatitis, is the finger webs. Other times you see web involvement, it's like scabies, right? But if you were to wash your hands a lot, you trap the soap in between the fingers, that's what causes that kind of irritant rash that shows up in between the fingers. If it's a glove, the glove is gonna touch the dorsum hands, the palmar hands, the fingertips, usually sparing the intraweb areas because those are not the most common places for them to come in contact with. All right, feet allergic contact dermatitis. I don't see this as much as often as I do hand or face, for example, but certainly you can still develop contact dermatitis on the feet. My favorite pattern is B right there. So what do you guys notice? You guys notice there's arch sparing. In contact dermatitis, the arch is almost always spared on the feet. The reason for that is because the arch doesn't come in contact with the sole of the shoe nearly as often as the other pressure points of your feet. So if you're truly worried about shoe allergic contact dermatitis, whether it's the rubber soles, whether it's the leather soles, whether it's the some sort of glue that is used in the shoes, you will usually see arch sparing. I get a lot of referrals for arch-involved feet dermatitis. That's probably gonna be dyshidrotic eczema, probably gonna be plantar psoriasis, less likely to be contact dermatitis. I still patch test them because my colleagues thought this could be allergic contact dermatitis. We're gonna just prove that it is not. This is a picture of top of the feet involvement due to canvas shoes, one of the chemicals used to make the canvas shoes. You can see this pretty prominent involvement of the top of the feet, but sparing, again, of the interwebs of the toes, because those are not areas that typically come in contact with the shoe itself. We're thinking more of the broad surfaces on the top of the foot. Other pictures of allergic contact dermatitis here. You can see here that the top of the feet broadly involved. I have patients who come in with this who are just allergic to that little tag kind of on the tongue of their shoe. One thing I really like to do is to cut pieces of the shoe and stick it on their skin directly. That can oftentimes prove that they're actually allergic to that piece of shoe. Another discussion for another time. And then on the right-hand side, you see just that kind of scaly involvement between the big toe and the second toe there. That's oftentimes due to some sort of a thong sandal or something like that where there is just contact in that one area. Mimickers of feet dermatitis. On the left-hand side there, you can see psoriasis of the feet oftentimes can look directly like contact dermatitis, but you notice the kind of the involvement of the arch, right? And sparing of the rest of the foot, really just that involvement of the arch area, really that inverse pattern from the allergic contact dermatitis picture. On the right-hand side, we kind of see the onychomycosis, probably more likely to be some sort of tinea, or you can also think of this being nail involvement in psoriasis. It's really hard to tell until you do some sort of a clipping and culture of the toenails. 2 feet, one hand, something that we always like to teach our residents and medical students is that when you see both feet involvement as well as one hand involvement, that is tinea until proven otherwise, right? You wipe the bottom of your feet with your dominant hand typically, you get tinea on that hand as well as both of those feet. Don't treat this with topical steroids, treat it with an antifungal medication. Now, least specific for last, and I couldn't figure out what A was, right? It looks like just a palm. I mean, could that be stigmata of Christ? I don't really know. But that kind of palmar contact dermatitis, I have yet to see. I'm really looking for it, though. But you can certainly get body-wide contact dermatitis. Now, this is a little bit harder, because how do you know this is not just atopic dermatitis? How do you know this is not a drug reaction? How do you know this is not something else that is going on? It doesn't really have a specific pattern, but there are some things to kind of pay attention to here. This is a 14-year-old girl that I saw in clinic with a history of arm and leg rash for the last 2 years. It's much worse when she plays hockey, and she plays hockey for 11 out of 12 months. She's tried a lot of different types of topical as well as systemic intervention. None of it really seems to cure her rash. It temporarily makes it better, but then it gets a little bit worse. But she is highly suspicious of her hockey equipment. You can see this kind of these erythematous, itchy papules that kind of show up on her thigh. She has it on her arms. She has it on her hands. And we patch tested her, and we found that she was allergic to an allergen called acetophenone-azine. Now, this is not something that we often hear about, but it was named the ACDS Allergen of the Year in 2021. This award is not given to most important allergens. This award is given to allergens that we are trying to bring attention to the general public, just because we are seeing an increasing trend in them when we are patch testing. What's acetophenone-azine? This is an allergen that is found in the production of a certain type of foam that's used in sports equipment as well as shoes. And it can be seen in flip-flops, ski boots, soccer gear, things like that. So on the left-hand side, for example, that's a picture of shin dermatitis to someone that could be allergic to a component of her shin pads. In the middle, it's a diabetic monitor allergic reaction. There's an allergen that we've been identifying in diabetic monitors called isoborno acrylate. That was the contact allergen of the year, I believe, in 2022, just to try to bring attention to the fact that these adhesive chemicals in these wireless diabetic monitors can also cause allergic contact dermatitis. And then on the far right-hand side there is an example of contact dermatitis due to a knee implant, and we can certainly see that as well. Sometimes you will see a rash develop over the site of the implant that secondarily generalizes to the rest of the body. So this is where history is pretty important. When did you get the implant? When did the rash appear? Where did it first appear? And things like that, and that can sometimes clue you in. Now, the mimickers are very, very, very broad. On the left-hand side here, we're looking at just atopic dermatitis, right? Like, how can you tell the difference when it's just atopic dermatitis? When it's allergic contact dermatitis, you really can't. In the middle there, we're thinking CTCL. Anytime you have atopic dermatitis that is not responding to treatment, that is not responding to a biologic, or you have kind of this funny pattern of dermatitis, maybe involving the bathing trunk area, we have to think about mycosis fungoides. And then on the far right-hand side, our favorite, scabies, right? So scabies in kids can involve the head and neck area. Scabies in adults typically affects the neck down. We're looking at the interwebs. We're looking in the armpits. We're looking in the groin. Just these really miserable, itchy people. You don't want to miss scabies in this population. So today we kind of talked about regional patterns of contact dermatitis, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg. When we're thinking about contact dermatitis, there are a lot of other things that can really cause it. There's metal hypersensitivity due to implanted metals. There's systemic contact dermatitis due to foods that we do ingest. I know I did say that contact dermatitis usually is not due to foods, but sometimes things like nickel, for example, can be present in our foods. Oatmeal is notoriously high in nickel, for example. And I have seen patients who are reactive to cobalt, so another metal that we think about. But cobalt is also in vitamin B12, and I've seen patients who had bariatric surgery and now on 5,000% of vitamin B12 supplements because they can no longer absorb vitamin B12 from their gut that have developed systemic contact dermatitis to their B12 supplement. So there's a lot more to talk about there as well. And so some take-home points that I want you guys to kind of walk away with. Specific patterns of dermatoses can suggest contact dermatitis. Doesn't prove it, but it can suggest it, and that's when we should do patch testing. Patch testing is really the only gold standard for allergic contact dermatitis. You might have heard a blood test called lymphocyte transformation assay. It doesn't work very well, and there's no validation for that. Broad testing is necessary. If you have true test, use it. Better than nothing. But if it's negative, you can't really say this is not truly allergic contact dermatitis. And the phrase I always like to use is more is always more. The more you patch test, the more likely you are to find the relevant allergen on the patient. If you can't do comprehensive patch testing and you're highly suspicious this is allergic contact dermatitis, use the ACDS Find a Provider site. Find somebody who does comprehensive patch testing in your community. It might be worthwhile, because think about it as steroid sparing. Think about it as systemic sparing. They may not need those drugs that you were planning on putting them on if there is a contact allergen they can avoid. And finally, don't forget to consider alternatives, especially when the patch testing is negative. You think this person has some sort of dermatitis, they patch test negative, they don't respond to dupilumab, please biopsy them, make sure they don't have something like mycosis fungoides or one of those other conditions. And that's what I have for you guys. Thank you guys so much.